Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Also, links will be posted to it at kirksvilletoday.com and on our social medium, pieville.net. We're going to resume with Saki today and do four more stories. Let's turn to page 219 and begin. We're now more than a third of the way into the book, which is about 600 pages. First story we're going to do is Cousin Teresa, or Teresa, T-E-R-E-S-A, Cousin Teresa. Bassett Harrowcluff. C-L-U-F-F, returned to the home of his fathers after an absence of 4 years, distinctly well pleased with himself. He was only 31, but he had put in some useful service in an out-of-the-way, though not unimportant, corner of the world. He had quieted a province, kept open a trade route, enforced the tradition of respect, which is worth the ransom of many kings in out-of-the-way regions, and done the whole business on rather less expenditure than would be requisite for organizing a charity in the home country. Again, Britain is an empire, and bold, competent young men created, preserved, and extended, and maintained the empire. But it was shortly to all fall apart. And he'd done it for very little money. In Whitehall, that's British government, in places where they think, they doubtless thought well of him. It was not inconceivable, his father allowed himself to imagine, that Bassett's name might figure in the next list of honors. Bassett was inclined to be rather contemptuous of his half-brother, Lucas, whom he found feverishly engrossed in the same medley of elaborate futilities that had claimed his whole time and energies, such as they were, 4 years ago, and almost as far back as before that as he could remember. It was the contempt of the man of action for the man of activities, and it was probably reciprocated. Lucas was an over-well-nourished individual. Fat. A fatty, fatty. Some 9 years Bassett senior, with a coloring that would have been accepted as a sign of intensive culture in an asparagus, but probably meant in this case a mere abstention from exercise. His hair and forehead furnished a recessional note in a personality that was, in all other respects, obtrusive and assertive. So I guess he's fat, lazy, and aggressive. There was certainly no Semitic blood in Lucas's parentage, but his appearance contrived to convey at least a suggestion of Jewish extraction. So even back then in print, you could get a word of criticism of Jews in, or at least acknowledge their racial characteristics. Clovis Sangrail, who knew most of his associates by sight, said it was undoubtedly a case of protective mimicry. 2 days after Bassett's return, Lucas frisked into lunch in a state of twittering excitement that could not be restrained, even for the immediate consideration of soup, but had to be verbally discharged in spluttering competition with mouthfuls of vermicelli. "I've got hold of an idea for something immense," he babbled, "something that is simply it, with a capital I. I've got hold of an idea for something immense, something that is simply it." Bassett gave a short laugh that would have done equally well as a snort if one had wanted to make the exchange. His half-brother was in the habit of discovering futilities that were simply it at frequently recurring intervals. The discovery generally meant that he flew up to town, preceded by glowingly worded telegrams, to see someone connected with the stage or the publishing world, got together one or two momentous luncheon parties, flitted in and out of Gambrinus for one or two evenings. I don't know if that's some kind of club or nightclub or men's club or something, and returned home with an air of subdued importance and the asparagus tint slightly intensified. The great idea was generally forgotten a few weeks later in the excitement of some new discovery. "The inspiration came to me whilst I was dressing," announced Lucas. "It will be the thing in the next music hall review. All London will go mad over it. It's just a couplet Of course, there will be other words, but they won't matter. Listen. Cousin Teresa takes out Caesar, Fido Jock, and the big Borzoi. A lilting, catchy sort of refrain, you see, and the big drum business on the two syllables of Borzoi. It's immense, and I've thought out all the business of it. The singer will sing the first verse alone. Then during the second verse, Cousin Teresa will walk through, followed by four wooden dogs on wheels. Caesar will be an Irish terrier, Fido a black poodle, Jock a fox terrier, and the Borzoi, of course, will be a Borzoi. During the third verse, Cousin Teresa will come on alone, and the dogs will be drawn across by themselves from the opposite wing. Then Cousin Teresa will catch on to the singer and go off stage in one direction, while the dog's procession goes off in the other, crossing en route, which is always very effective. There'll be a lot of applause there, and for the fourth verse, Cousin Teresa will come on in sables, and the dogs will all have coats on. Then I've got a great idea for the fifth verse. Each of the dogs will be led on by a nut, and Cousin Teresa will come on from the opposite side, crossing en route, always effective, and then she turns round and leads the whole lot of them off on a string. And all the time, everyone singing like mad. Cousin Teresa takes out Caesar, Fido, Jock, and the big Borzoi. Tum tum. Drum business in the last two syllables. I'm so excited I shan't sleep a wink tonight. I'm off tomorrow by the 10:15. I've wired to Herman Ovid to lunch with me. If any of the rest of the family felt any excitement over the creation of Cousin Teresa, they were signally successful in concealing the fact. Poor Lucas does take his silly little ideas seriously, said Colonel Harold Clough afterwards in the smoking room. Yes, said his younger son in a slightly less tolerant tone. In a day or two, he'll come back and tell us that his seasonal masterpiece is above the heads of the public. And in about 3 weeks' time, he'll be wild with enthusiasm over a scheme to dramatize the poems of Herrick or something equally promising. And then an extraordinary thing befell. In defiance of all precedent, Lucas's glowing anticipations were justified and endorsed by the course of events. If Cousin Teresa was above the heads of the public heroically adapted itself to her altitude. Introduced as an experiment at a dull moment in a new review, the success of the item was unmistakable. The calls were so insistent and uproarious that even Lucas's ample devisings of additional business scarcely sufficed to keep pace with the demand. Packed houses on successive evenings confirmed the verdict of the first night audience. Stalls and boxes filled significantly just before the turn came on and emptied significantly after the last encore had been given. The manager tearfully acknowledged that Cousin Teresa was it. Stagehands and supers and program sellers acknowledged it to one another without the least reservation. The name of the review dwindled to secondary importance, and vast letters of electric blue blazoned the words, Cousin Teresa, from the front of the great palace of pleasure. And, of course, the magic of the famous refrain laid its spell all over the metropolis. Restaurant proprietors were obliged to provide the members of their orchestras with painted wooden dogs on wheels in order that the much-demanded and always-conceited melody should be rendered with the necessary spectacular effects. And the crash of bottles and forks on the tables at the mention of the big Borzoi usually drowned the sincerest efforts of drum or cymbals. Nowhere and at no time could one get away from the double thump that brought up the rear of the refrain. Revelers reeling home at night banged it on doors and hoardings. Milkmen clashed their cans to its cadence. Messenger boys hit smaller messenger boys, resounding double smacks on the same principle. And the more thoughtful circles of the great city were not deaf to the claims and significance of the popular melody. An enterprising and emancipated preacher discoursed from his pulpit on the inner meaning of Cousin Teresa, and Lucas Harold Clough was invited to lecture on the subject of his great achievement to members of the Young Men's Endeavor League, the Nine Arts Club, and other learned and willing to learn bodies. Learned and willing to learn bodies. In society, it seemed to be the one thing people really cared to talk about. Men and women of middle age and average education might be seen together in corners earnestly discussing not the question of whether Serbia should have an outlet on the Adriatic, Serbia with a V is how it used to be, or the possibilities of a British success in international polo contest, but the more absorbing topic of the problematic Aztec or Nilotic origin of the Teresa motif. "Politics and patriotism are so boring and so out of date," said a revered lady who had some pretensions to oracular utterance. "We are too cosmopolitan nowadays to be really moved by them. That is why one welcomes an intelligible production like Cousin Teresa. That has a genuine message for one. One can't understand the message all at once, of course, but one felt from the very first that it was there. I've been to see it 18 times, and I'm going again tomorrow and on Thursday. One can't see it often enough." "It would be a rather popular move if we gave this Harrowcluff person a knighthood or something of the sort," said the minister reflectively. "Which Harrowcluff?" said his secretary. "Which? There's only one, isn't there?" said the minister. "The Cousin Teresa man, of course. I think everyone would be pleased if we knighted him." "Yes, you can put him down in the list of certainties under the letter L." "The letter L," said the secretary, who was new to his job. "Does that stand for liberalism or liberality?" Most of the recipients of the ministerial favor were expected to qualify in both of those subjects. "Literature," said the minister. And thus, after a fashion, Colonel Harrowcluff's expectation of seeing his son's name in the list of honors was gratified. So there he's making a little comment on the nature of fame and luck and chance and earning and meriting and deserving something and what that actually means and how people who are famous got to be famous. And there's a lot of, and also even maybe the nature of art or artist, that Behnken used to say that 9 out of 10 artists are deadbeats and debauchers of virgins. And in a slightly similar vein, he's saying here that a lot of artistic production is no less unworthy, rather than you expect me to say worthy, no less unworthy than what didn't succeed, yet it does succeed, and it may simply be due to chance or the spirit of the times or simply boredom with something else that it neatly countercrosses. In the way, you know, some kind of food cuts across another, like, say, pork chops and cranberries. The next story is the Yarkand Manor, Yarkand, the Yarkand Manor. And I always spell stuff out. I know it's annoying. It's annoying to me, too. But otherwise, you hear something, and if it's not completely familiar, You're wondering if you're hearing it correctly. And even if you are hearing it correctly, you're wondering how it's spelled. Or maybe that's just me. But anyway, that's how I do it. Sir Lulworth Quayne. And we had a Lulworth last session, I recall. I don't remember if his name was Quayne or not. But anyway, Sir Lulworth Quayne was making a leisurely progress through the Zoological Society's gardens in company with his nephew, again, the Yarkand Manor. Recently returned from Mexico, his nephew, just back from Mexico. The latter was interested in comparing and contrasting allied types of animals occurring in the North American and Old World fauna. Fauna, of course, means animals, plural. Flora means plants, plural. One of the most remarkable things in the wandering of species, he observed, is the sudden impulse to trek and migrate that breaks out now and then, for no apparent reason, in communities of hitherto stay-at-home animals. In human affairs, the same phenomenon is occasionally noticeable, said Sir Lulworth. Perhaps the most striking instance of it occurred in this country while you were away in the wilds of Mexico. I mean the wander fever, which suddenly displayed itself in the managing and editorial staffs of certain London newspapers. It began with the stampede of the entire staff of one of our most brilliant and enterprising weeklies to the banks of the Seine, in France, Paris, and the heights of Montmartre. The migration was a brief one, but it heralded an era of restlessness in the press world, which lent quite a new meaning to the phrase newspaper circulation. Other editorial staffs were not slow to imitate the example that had been set them. Paris soon dropped out of fashion as being too near home. Nuremberg, Seville, and Salonika became more favored as planning out grounds for the personnel of not only weekly but daily papers as well. The localities were perhaps not always well chosen. The fact of a leading organ of evangelical thought being edited for two successive fortnights from Trouville and Monte Carlo was generally admitted to have been a mistake, and even when enterprising and adventurous editors took themselves and their staffs further afield, there were some unavoidable clashings. For instance, the Scrutator, Sporting Bluff, and the Damsel's Own Paper all pitched on Khartoum, it's in the Sudan, for the same week. It was, perhaps, a desire to outdistance all possible competition that influenced the management of the Daily Intelligencer, one of the most solid and respected organs of liberal opinion, in its decision to transfer its offices for 3 or 4 weeks from Fleet Street to eastern Turkestan, allowing, of course, a necessary margin of time for the journey there and back. This was, in many respects, the most remarkable of all the press stampedes that were experienced at this time. There was no make-believe about the undertaking. Proprietor, manager, editors, sub-editors, leader writers, principal reporters, and so forth, all took part in what was popularly alluded to as the Drang nach Osten. An intelligent and efficient office boy was all that was left in the deserted hive of editorial industry. That was doing things rather thoroughly, wasn't it? Said the nephew. Well, you see, said Sir Lulworth, the migration idea was falling somewhat into disrepute from the half-hearted manner in which it was occasionally carried out. You were not impressed by the information that such and such a paper was being edited and brought out at Lisbon or Innsbruck, if you chanced to see the principal leader writer or the art editor lunching as usual at their accustomed restaurants. The Daily Intelligencer was determined to give no loophole for cavil at the genuineness of its pilgrimage, and it must be admitted that, to a certain extent, the arrangements made for transmitting copy and carrying on the usual features of the paper during the long outward journey worked smoothly and well. The series of articles which commenced at Baku on, quote, what Cobdenism might do for the camel industry, ranks among the best of the recent contributions to free trade literature, while the views on foreign policy enunciated, quote, from a roof in Yarkand, close quote, showed at least as much grasp of the international situation as those that had germinated within half a mile of Downing Street. Quite in keeping, too, with the older and better traditions of British journalism was the matter of the homecoming. No bombast, no personal advertisement, no flamboyant interviews, even a complimentary luncheon at the Voyagers Club was courteously declined. Indeed, it began to be felt that the self-effacement of the return pressman was being carried to a pedantic length. Pedantic. Foreman compositors, advertisement clerks, and other members of the non-editorial staff, who had, of course, taken no part in the great trek, found it as impossible to get into direct communication with the editor and his satellites now that they had returned as when they had been excusably inaccessible in Central Asia. The sulky, overworked office boy, who was the one connecting link between the editorial brain and the business departments of the paper, sardonically explained the new aloofness as the, quote, Yarkand manner. Most of the reporters and sub-editors seemed to have been dismissed in autocratic fashion since their return, and new ones engaged by letter. To these, the editor and his immediate associates remained an unseen presence, issuing its instructions solely through the medium of curt typewritten notes. Something mystic and Tibetan and forbidden had replaced the human bustle and democratic simplicity of pre-migration days, and the same experience was encountered by those who made social overtures to the returned wanderers. The most brilliant hostess of 20th century London flung the pearl of her hospitality into the unresponsive trough of the editorial letterbox. It seemed as if nothing short of a royal command would drag the hermit-souled revenants from their self-imposed seclusion. People began to talk of, and I think that's a ghost, I think there was actually a horror movie called The Revenant. So nothing would drag, short of a royal command, would drag these ghosts out of their self-imposed seclusion. People began to talk unkindly of the effect of high altitudes and eastern atmosphere on minds and temperaments unused to such luxuries. The Yarkand manner was not popular. And the contents of the paper, said the nephew, did they show the influence of the new style? Ah, said Sir Lulworth, that was the exciting thing. In home affairs, social questions, and the ordinary events of the day, not much change was noticeable. A certain Oriental carelessness seemed to have crept into the editorial department, and perhaps a note of lassitude not unnatural in the work of men who had returned from what had been a fairly arduous journey. The aforetime standard of excellence was scarcely maintained, but at any rate, the general lines of policy and outlook were not departed from. It was in the realm of foreign affairs that a startling change took place. Blunt, forcible, outspoken articles appeared, couched in language which nearly turned the autumn maneuvers of six important powers into mobilizations. Whatever else the Daily Intelligencer had learned in the East, it had not acquired the art of diplomatic ambiguity. The man in the street enjoyed the articles and bought the paper as he never had bought it before. The men in Downing Street took a different view. The foreign secretary, hitherto accounted a rather reticent man, correct use of the word, shy, retiring, became positively garrulous in the course of a perpetually disavowing the sentiments expressed in the Daily Intelligencer's leaders. And then one day the government came to the conclusion that something definite and drastic must be done. A deputation consisting of the prime minister, the foreign secretary, four leading financiers, and a well-known nonconformist, capital N, divine, that's a preacher, one of Mencken's favorite words, talking about priests, preachers, he would call them divines, their followers like adepts, masters in something, another word you rarely see used nowadays. These words were much more used around 1900, 1920. So a deputation, a prime minister, foreign secretary, leading bankman, and a well-known nonconformist divine made its way to the offices of the paper. At the door leading to the editorial department, the way was barred by a nervous but defiant office boy. "You can't see the editor nor any of the staff," he announced. "We insist on seeing the editor, or some responsible person," said the prime minister, and the deputation forced its way in. The boy had spoken truly. There was no one to be seen. In the whole suite of rooms, there was no sign of human life. "Where's the editor, the foreign editor, the chief leader writer, anybody?" In answer to the shower of questions, the boy unlocked a drawer and produced a strange-looking envelope which bore a Khokand, Khokand, postmark, and a date of some 7 or 8 months back. It contained a scrap of paper on which was written the following message: "Entire party captured by brigand tribe on homeward journey. $250,000 demanded as ransom, but would probably take less. Inform government, relations, and friends." There followed the signatures of the principal members of the party and instructions as to how and where the money was to be paid. The letter had been directed to the office boy in charge, who had quietly suppressed it. No one is a hero to one's own office boy, and he evidently considered that $250,000 was an unwarrantable outlay for such a doubtfully advantageous object as the repatriation of an errant newspaper staff. So he drew the editorial and the other salaries, forged what signatures were necessary, engaged new reporters, did what sub-editing he could, and made as much use as possible of the large accumulation of special articles that was held in reserve for emergencies. The articles on foreign affairs were entirely his own composition. Of course, the whole thing had to be kept as quiet as possible. An interim staff, pledged to secrecy, was appointed to keep the paper going till the pining captives could be sought out, ransomed, and brought home in twos and threes to escape notice, and gradually things were put back on their old footing. The articles on foreign affairs reverted to the wonted traditions of the paper. "But," interposed the nephew, "how on earth did the boy account to the relatives of all these months of the non-appearance?" "That," said Sir Lulworth, "was the most brilliant stroke of all. To the wife or nearest relative of each of the missing men, he forwarded a letter, copying the handwriting of the supposed writer as well as he could, and making excuses about vile pens and ink. In each letter, he told the same story, varying only the locality, to the effect that the writer, alone of the whole party, was unable to tear himself away from the wild liberty and allurements of Eastern life, and was going to spend several months roaming in some selected region. Many of the wives started off immediately in pursuit of their errant husbands, and it took the government a considerable time and much trouble to reclaim them from their fruitless quests along the banks of the Oxus, the Gobi Desert, the Orenburg Steppe, and other outlandish places. One of them, I believe, is still lost somewhere in the Tigris Valley. And the boy is still in journalism. A nice little satire of journalism, somewhat reminiscent of Evelyn Waugh. And when I worked in conservatism, the fellow was an Irish Catholic I worked for, and they were very, very big on Evelyn Waugh, who was himself a Catholic. He wrote a number of satires. I can't even think of their name, but one of them, the Daily Beast. Now, there actually is a Daily Beast now, but he is where that comes from. He wrote the original satirical number. He wrote, I don't know, at least a dozen, maybe two dozen. Scoop, I think is the title. Black Mischief, something like that. Brideshead Revisited, even. These are all nows. Look up Evelyn Waugh. There are a number of Waughs, but Evelyn Waugh, worth reading. And this is in that vein, but actually precedes it, of course. Evelyn Waugh was more the middle, 30s onward. Decades. I'm not sure if he wrote in the 20s. I don't recall. Third story, the Byzantine omelet. Sophie Chattel Monkheim, hyphenated last name, was a socialist by conviction and a Chattel Monkheim by marriage. The particular member of that wealthy family whom she had married was rich, even as his relatives counted riches. Sophie had very advanced and decided views as to the distribution of money. It was a pleasing and fortunate circumstance that she also had the money. When she inveighed eloquently against the evils of capitalism at drawing-room meetings and Fabian conferences, she was conscious of a comfortable feeling that the system, with all its inequalities and iniquities, would probably last her time. So all this redistribution may happen. It may even be a good thing, but as long as I have the riches while I'm alive, that's all she really cared about. Fabianism is socialism by degree and nonviolently. That is democratic socialism versus, I don't know if it's opposed to scientific socialism of Marx, but it's certainly, it's opposed to the violence of Marxist revolution. You degree by degree by degree is Fabian socialism. So that's what, whenever you see Fabian, that's what it means. It is one of the consolations of middle-aged reformers that the good they inculcate must live after them if it is to live at all. On a certain spring evening, somewhere towards the dinner hour, Sophie sat tranquilly between her mirror and her maid, undergoing the process of having her hair built into an elaborate reflection of the prevailing fashion. She was hedged round with a great peace, the peace of one who has attained a desired end with much effort and perseverance, and who has found it still eminently desirable in its attainment. The Duke of Syria had consented to come beneath her roof as a guest, was even now installed beneath her roof, and would shortly be sitting at her dinner table. As a good socialist, Sophie disapproved of social distinctions and derided the idea of a princely caste. But if there were to be these artificial gradations of rank and dignity, she was pleased and anxious to have an exalted specimen of an exalted order included in her house party. So he's making the point, socialists like the same things as everybody else, they just can't admit it for ideological reasons. Preach one thing, believe another, do another. She was broad-minded enough to love the sinner while hating the sin. Now there's an excellent use of that. Not that she entertained any warm feeling of personal affection for the Duke of Syria, who was a comparative stranger, but still, as Duke of Syria, he was very, very welcome beneath her roof. Again, English values status and money. You've seen in two paragraphs, he's proven what I always say. They value status and money over everything, and that attitude carried into America. And it's why the people who value status and money are always on the road to becoming cucks, because they're soul cucks. They have the wrong values, and the people who value racial loyalty above everything are going to defeat them and then employ them as butlers and cuck servants, as I like to say. And those would be the Jews, of course. So she doesn't know the guy, but he's welcome beneath the roof, even though she's a professed socialist, because he's rich and he has a title. She could not have explained why, but no one was likely to ask her for an explanation, and most hostesses envied her. "You must surpass yourself tonight, Richardson," she said complacently to her maid. "I must be looking my very best. We must all surpass ourselves." The maid said nothing. Here's her actual interaction with the working class she's advocating for. The maid said nothing, but from the concerned look in her eyes and the deft play of her fingers, it was evident that she was beset with the ambition to surpass herself. A knock came at the door, a quiet but peremptory knock, as of someone who would not be denied. "Go and see who it is," said Sophie. "It may be something about the wine." Richardson held a hurried conference with an invisible messenger at the door. When she returned, there was noticeable a curious listlessness in place of her hitherto alert manner. "What is it?" asked Sophie. "The household servants have down tools, madam," said Richardson. "Let's go on strike." "Down tools!" exclaimed Sophie. "Do you mean to say they've gone on strike?" "Yes, madam," said Richardson, adding the information. "It's Gaspar that the trouble is about." "Gaspar?" said Sophie wonderingly. "The emergency chef, the omelet specialist." "Yes, madam. Before he became an omelet specialist, he was a valet, and he was one of the strike breakers in the great strike at Lord Grimford's 2 years ago. As soon as the household staff here learned that you had engaged him, they resolved to down tools, I guess that was their expression of the time for a strike, as a protest. They haven't got any grievance against you personally, but they demand that Gaspar should be immediately dismissed." "But," protested Sophie, "he is the only man in England who understands how to make a Byzantine omelet. I engaged him specially for the Duke of Syria's visit, and it would be impossible to replace him at a short notice. I should have to send to Paris, and the Duke loves Byzantine omelets. It was the one thing we talked about, coming from the station." "He was one of the strike breakers at Lord Grimford's," reiterated Richardson. "This is too awful," said Sophie. "A strike of servants at a moment like this, with the Duke of Syria staying in the house. Something must be done immediately. Quick, finish my hair, and I'll go see what I can do to bring them round."
"I can't finish your hair, madam," said Richardson quietly, but with immense decision. "I belong to the Union, and I can't do another half minute's of work. I can't do another half minute's work till the strike is settled. I'm sorry to be disobliging."
"But this is inhuman," exclaimed Sophie tragically. "I've always been a model mistress, and I refuse to employ any but Union servants, and this is the result? I can't finish my hair myself. I don't know how to. What am I to do? It's wicked."
"Wicked is the word," said Richardson. "I'm a good conservative, and I've no patience with this socialist foolery, asking your pardon. It's tyranny, that's what it is, all along the line. But I've my living to make, same as other people, and I've got to belong to the Union. I couldn't touch another hairpin without a strike permit, not if you was to double my wages." The door burst open, and Catherine Malsom raged into the room.
"Here's a nice affair," she screamed. "A strike of household servants without a moment's warning, and I'm left like this. I can't appear in public in this condition."
After a very hasty scrutiny, Sophie assured her that she could not.
"Have they all struck?" she asked her maid.
"Not the kitchen staff," said Richardson. "They belong to a different union."
"Dinner, at least, will be assured," said Sophie. "That is something to be thankful for."
"Dinner," snorted Catherine. "What on earth is the good of a dinner when none of us will be able to appreciate it? Look at your hair, and look at me, or rather don't."
"I know it's difficult to manage without a maid. Can't your husband be any help to you?" asked Sophie despairingly.
"Henry, he's in a worse case than any of us. His man is the only person who really understands that ridiculous newfangled Turkish bath that he insists on taking with him everywhere."
"Surely he could do without a Turkish bath for one evening," said Sophie. "I can't appear without hair, but a Turkish bath is a luxury."
"My good woman," said Catherine, speaking with a fearful intensity, "Henry was in the bath when the strike started.
In it, do you understand? He's there now."
"Can't he get out?"
"He doesn't know how to. Every time he pulls a lever marked release, he only releases hot steam.
There are two kinds of steam in the bath, bearable and scarcely bearable. He has released them both. By this time, I'm probably a widow. I simply can't send away Gaspar, wailed Sophie. I should never be able to secure another omelet specialist. Any difficulty that I may experience in securing another husband is, of course, a trifle beneath anyone's consideration, said Catherine bitterly. He's spoofing upper-class women. I'm sure you realized. Sophie capitulated. Go, she said to Richardson, and tell the strike committee or whoever are directing this affair that Gaspar is herewith dismissed, and ask Gaspar to see me presently in the library, where I will pay him what is due to him and make what excuses I can, and then fly back and finish my hair. Some half an hour later, Sophie marshaled her guests in the grand salon, preparatory to the formal march to the dining room. Except that Henry Malsom was of the ripe raspberry tint that one sometimes sees at private theatricals representing the human complexion, there was little outward sign among those assembled at the crisis that had just been encountered and surmounted. But the tension had been too stupefying while it lasted not to leave some mental effects behind it. Sophie talked at random to her illustrious guest and found her eyes straying with increasing frequency towards the great doors through which would presently come the blessed announcement that dinner was served. Now and again she glanced mirrorward at the reflection of her wonderfully coiffed hair, as an insurance underwriter might gaze thankfully at an overdue vessel that had ridden safely into harbor in the wake of a devastating hurricane. Then the doors opened and the welcome figure of the butler entered the room. But he made no general announcement of a banquet in readiness, and the doors closed behind him. His message was for Sophie alone. "There is no dinner, madam," he said gravely. "The kitchen staff have downed tools." Gaspar belongs to the union of cooks and kitchen employees, and as soon as they heard of his summary dismissal at a moment's notice, they struck work. They demand his instant reinstatement and an apology to the union. I may add, madame, that they are very firm. I've been obliged even to hand back the dinner rolls that were already on the table. After the lapse of 18 months, Sophie Chatel Munkheim is beginning to go about again among her old haunts and associates, but she still has to be very careful. The doctors will not let her attend anything at all exciting, such as a drawing-room meeting or a Fabian conference. It is doubtful, indeed, whether she wants to. So she had some of her socialism handed to her, and when reality meets theory, there can be unpleasant results for those whose theories aren't based in reality. And this sort of thing is why, you know, it's art, and it's not a political message, but yet it contains implicit political messages, which are, as I've indicated. Last story for today will be the Feast of Nemesis. The Feast of Nemesis. So hubris precedes nemesis. Excessive pride leads to downfall. Greek, hubris, excessive pride, nemesis, your downfall. It's a good thing that St. Valentine's Day has dropped out of vogue, said Mrs. Thackenbury, almost a normal name for sake. What with Christmas and New Year and Easter, not to speak of birthdays, there are quite enough remembrance days as it is. I tried to save myself trouble at Christmas by just sending flowers to all my friends, but it wouldn't work. Gertrude has 11 hothouses and about 30 gardeners, so it would have been ridiculous to send flowers to her, and Millie has just started a florist shop, so it was equally out of the question there. The stress of having to decide in a hurry what to give Gertrude and Millie, just when I thought I'd got the whole question nicely off my mind, completely ruined my Christmas, and then the awful monotony of the letters of thanks. Thank you so much for your lovely flowers. It was so good of you to think of me. Of course, in the majority of cases, I hadn't thought about the recipients at all. Their names were down in my list of people who must not be left out. If I trusted to remembering them, there would be some awful sins of omission. The trouble is, said Clovis to his aunt, all of these days of intrusive remembrance harp so persistently on one aspect of human nature and entirely ignore the other. That is why they become so perfunctory and artificial. At Christmas and New Year, you are emboldened and encouraged by convention to send gushing messages of optimistic goodwill and servile affection to people whom you would scarcely ask to lunch, unless someone else had failed you at the last moment. If you are supping at a restaurant on New Year's Eve, you are permitted and expected to join hands and sing for Auld Lang Syne with strangers whom you have never seen before and never want to see again. But no license is allowed in the opposite direction. Opposite direction? What opposite direction? Queried Mrs. Thackenberry. There is no outlet for demonstrating your feelings towards people whom you simply loathe. That is really the crying need of our modern civilization. Just think how jolly it would be if a recognized day were set apart for the paying off of old scores and grudges. You think the writer, I believe the Irish guy who invented Festivus, you think he'd read any sake? That's originality among artists. And it is originality, even if it's merely something slightly new. It's not as new as people think, generally. I've made that point many times before. Here's an excellent example. I'll bet you anything. Maybe it's one of the Houlihan or whatever, O'Herlihy's, maybe. There's some Irish guy. Most of the sitcom writers are Jews or they're East Coast Irish and then a smattering of others. But I would not be surprised in the least. In fact, I would guarantee you that he has read Saki and might specifically well have been thinking of this very line. This Clovis concept. There is no outlet for demonstrating your feelings toward people whom you simply loathe. Remember what in Festivus, the airing of grievances could easily spring from this ground. That is really the crying need of our modern civilization. Just think how jolly it would be if a recognized day were set apart for the paying off of old scores and grudges. A day when one could lay oneself out to be gracefully vindictive to a carefully treasured list of, quote, people who must not be let off. I remember when I was at a private school, we had one day last May of the last Monday of the term, I think it was, consecrated to the settlement of feuds and grudges. Of course, we did not appreciate it as much as it deserved, because after all, any day of the term could be used for that purpose. Still, if one had chastised a smaller boy for being cheeky weeks before, one was always permitted on that day to recall the episode to his memory by chastising him again. That is what the French call reconstructing the crime. So, of course, Clovis is being witty and mischievous as always. I should call it reconstructing the punishment, said Mrs. Thackenberry in the typical, usual, witless, literal, female, and unimaginative way. And anyhow, I don't see how you could introduce a system of primitive schoolboy vengeance into civilized adult life. We haven't outgrown our passions, but we are supposed to have learned how to keep them within strictly decorous limits. Of course, the whole thing would have to be done furtively and politely, said Clovis. The charm of it would be that it would never be perfunctory, that is, machine-like or indifferent. There'd be real passionate feeling in it, like the other thing. Now, for instance, you say to yourself, I must show the Webleys some attention at Christmas. They were kind to dear Bertie at Bournemouth. And you send them a calendar, and a daily for 6 days after Christmas, the male Webley asked a female Webley if she has remembered to thank you for the calendar you sent them. Well, transplant that idea to the other and more human side of your nature and say to yourself, next Thursday is Nemesis Day. What on earth can I do to those odious people next door who made such an absurd fuss when Ping Yang bit their youngest child? Ping Yang would be what, their pet panda? I don't know. Then you'd get up awfully early on the allotted day, Nemesis Day, and climb over into their garden and dig for truffles on their tennis court with a good gardening fork, choosing, of course, that part of the court that was screened from observation by the laurel bushes. You wouldn't find any truffles, but you would find a great peace, such as no amount of present giving could ever bestow. So mess up their lawn, their grass tennis court, looking for imaginary truffles. I shouldn't, said Mrs. Thackenberry, though her air of protest sounded a bit forced. I should feel rather a worm for doing such a thing. You exaggerate the power of upheaval which a worm would be able to bring into play in the limited time available, said Clovis. If you put in a strenuous 10 minutes with a really useful fork, the result ought to suggest the operations of an unusually masterful mole or a badger in a hurry. They might guess I had done it, said Mrs. Thackenberry. Of course they would, said Clovis. That would be half the satisfaction of the thing. just as you like people at Christmas to know what presents or cards you sent them. The thing would be much easier to manage, of course, when you were on outwardly friendly terms with the object of your dislike. That greedy little Agnes Blake, for instance, who thinks of nothing but her food, it would be quite simple to ask her to a picnic in some wild woodland spot and lose her just before lunch was served. When you found her again, every morsel of food could have been eaten up. It would require no ordinary human strategy to lose Agnes Blake when luncheon was imminent. In fact, I don't believe it could be done. Then have all the other guests, people whom you dislike, and lose the luncheon. It could have been sent by accident in the wrong direction. It would be a ghastly picnic, said Mrs. Thackenbury. For them, but not for you, said Clovis. You would have had an early and comforting lunch before you started, and you could improve the occasion by mentioning in detail the items of the missing banquet, the lobster Newburgh and the egg mayonnaise and the curry that was to have been heated in a chafing dish. Agnes Blake would be delirious long before you got to the list of wines, and in the long interval of waiting, before they had quite abandoned hope of the lunch turning up, you could induce them to play silly games, such as that idiotic one of the, quote, Lord Mayor's dinner party, in which everyone has to choose the name of a dish and do something futile when it is called out. In this case, they would probably burst into tears when their dish is mentioned. It would be a heavenly picnic. Mrs. Thackenbury was silent for a moment. She was probably making a mental list of the people she would like to invite to the Duke Humphrey picnic. Presently, she asked, "And that odious young man, Waldo Plubley, who is always coddling himself, have you thought of anything that one could do to him?" Evidently, she was beginning to see the possibilities of Nemesis Day. "If there was anything like a general observance of the festival," said Clovis, "Waldo would be in such demand that you would have to bespeak him weeks beforehand." Notice bespeak, like in clothes, it means like specially tailored. So you'd have to bespeak him weeks before. This is how you learn how to use English, by reading the great writers, just as you learn actual human motivation and psychology by reading the greatest writers you can find. And there's no doubt about who the greatest writers are. Absolutely. That's an utterly absurd argument by people who are ideological or simply idiots. So anyway, he's saying if there was anything like a general observance, this guy, Waldo Plubley, would be in high demand. You'd have to bespeak him weeks beforehand, and even then, if there were an east wind blowing or a cloud or two in the sky, he might be too careful of his precious self to come out. It would be rather jolly if you could lure him into a hammock in the orchard, just near the spot where there is a wasp nest every summer. A comfortable hammock on a warm afternoon would appeal to his indolent tastes. And then, when he was getting drowsy, a lighted fuse should be thrown into the nest to bring the wasp out in an indignant mass. Note the nice little indolent man and indignant wasps. And they would soon find, quote, a home away from home on Waldo's fat body. Notice how he loves the three or four Latinate syllable words, and then, but when it comes to punch, Waldo's face just says fat, fat. It hits hard. It takes some doing to get out of a hammock in a hurry, and you can picture the scene in your mind. They might sting him to death, protested Mrs. Thackenbury. Waldo is one of those people who would be enormously improved by death, said Clovis. But if you didn't want to go as far as that, you could have some wet straw ready to hand and set it alight under the hammock at the same time that the fuse was thrown into the nest. The smoke would keep all but the most militant of the wasps just outside the stinging line, and as long as Waldo remained within its protection, he would escape serious damage and could be eventually restored to his mother, kippered all over and swollen in places, but still perfectly recognizable. His mother would be my enemy for life, said Mrs. Thackenbury. That would be one greeting less to exchange at Christmas, said Clovis. I like that one. That was the Feast of Nemesis, and that was the final story we're gonna do today. So, more great stuff from Hector Hume and Roe, Sackey, the complete stories of. And thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again very soon for more from Hector Hugh Monroe, The Complete Stories of Saki. And as always, you can find it at vnnforum.com, everything that's part of our what we call the Learning College, vnnforum.com, and links to it posted elsewhere. Good day.